Subscribe to our free newsletter. Sign up at the RN homepage.
Good morning, I'm Michael Cathcart, and you are so very welcome to a sparkling new week of Books and Arts Daily. Today we take you to the Melbourne Writers' Festival, where the Australian writer Helen Garner reads from her chilling new book about the trial of Robert Farquharson, the Victorian father who was found guilty of deliberately drowning his three boys when he drove his car into a dam. That was back in 2005. And this weekend, Doctor Who fans saw the new Doctor in action for the first time. Do let me know what you make of the 12th Doctor. You can text us on 0418 22 65 76. That 0418 22 65 76, or tweet us at RN Books and Arts. And we'll also take some calls later on in the show. Also, the 100-year-old man who jumped out of the window and disappeared, the wonderful title of a best-selling Swedish novel, now a film. We'll ask how well it makes the change from page to screen with our regular reviewers, Thomas Caldwell and Alicia Sometimes. Good to be with you on RN this Monday morning. Now to a dispute that's erupted in the UK over images used in a BBC promotion. Now, two UK-based Australian artists who go by the name of Maslin and Mayra believe that their signature artistic device has been ripped off by the creative team behind a BBC Two World War One television promotion. Well, let's find out more. One half of Maslin and Mayra join us on the phone from the UK. Jennifer Mayra, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael.
So tell us about this BBC promotion. What does it show that relates to your work?
Tim and I have been working on a series of work since about 2004. It involves meticulously making images with mirrored sculptures, placing them in the landscape and documenting them with a film camera, very much responding to the environment and making the imagery.
You basically cut out a silhouette with a mirror, so it's a flat mirror. And as the camera moves around it, it captures the landscape behind the figure, but of course it also captures the landscape that's reflected in the mirror. And so there's a nice kind of play of the eye of what landscape is sort of real.
It's very much creating illusions.
It's a very effective illusion because the mirrored figure kind of melts in and out of the landscape. You see it and then you don't, because leaves and sand or whatever it is behind them are mirrored in what you're looking at.
Yes, exactly. Many of the images that we actually made in Australia. And the images that we did with soldiers, we actually took all of those images in Australia and New Zealand in about 2006. It's something that we've developed over a long time. We've exhibited it, the works that we've made in this series, all over the world. We've shown them at art fairs. We've produced a monograph in 2008 where a very well-respected curator discusses our use of mirrors and mirrored soldiers in our imagery. It's quite specific.
Now, the BBC has produced a promo that features what?
We were contacted by a lot of people saying, congratulations, fantastic commission for the BBC, and knew nothing about it. And we had a look online, and it was very easy to find. And it was just like looking at our own work, to be honest.
So it's an ad for a BBC show in which there are mirrored soldiers, flat silhouettes of soldiers made out of mirrors, in all sorts of landscapes, leafy landscapes mainly. And as the camera moves around the landscape, you see these figures kind of melting in and out of clarity because trees and whatnot are reflected in them, and they come in and out of clear definition. So what have you done? You've complained to the BBC, have you?
We have. You know, what does one do as an artist? You know, when you've developed an idea over a long period of time, do you just kind of take it or do you stand up for yourself? I think it's a very difficult situation. It is possible for there to be like-minded people around the world. You know, if you look at, you know, artistic developments, there are lots of artistic developments that are similar in people's work. But I think it's important that if you do something similar to someone else, you bring something to it. You adjust it. You bring something of your own concept to that. Yeah, if it has nothing to differentiate in it, how do you tell us apart?
Now, the BBC say that this work is thematically different from your work. What's your response to that?
Well, we have an entire essay written by someone in our book that begs to differ. He talks about our work specifically with soldiers. I'll give you a quote. "The figures whose visible weapons suggest soldiers are, of course, particularly suitable for allowing the idea of camouflage to emerge into prominence. Soldiers camouflage themselves in order to no longer be seen by the enemy. The mirror seems to provide an ideal camouflage inasmuch as it reflects nothing other than which it surrounds it. And yet the figures remain strangely visible, mirroring something incalculable." I mean, it's so specific. And that is, it published in a book in 2008 about us.
Yeah, and as you read it out, I'd have to say, in all fairness, that that does describe the impact that the BBC promo has. When I was a student, I used to frequently visit a house in which there was a cut-out image of Marilyn Monroe, a mirror, on the wall. It's not a new idea to cut out the silhouette of a person in a mirror.
Maybe not, but the language that we've developed and the concept that we've developed is quite unique.
Now, the BBC has sent you a letter which says in part this: "The BBC team who worked on this project were not previously aware of your work. With regards to the image itself, the idea was conceived by the creative team at Karmarama, an advertising agency, and brought to life through a commissioned artist and a bespoke shoot." That just means a special filming expedition they went on. "Everything has been created from scratch. And you'll see from the following web link that our commissioned artist has been creating mirrored sculptures for some time. And it's clear from your website that your work using mirrored figures is highly regarded, but we don't accept that this prevents others from undertaking projects using similar forms or techniques." So they're saying their artist has come up with the same idea. And basically, you're in a sort of Charles Darwin situation. Someone else has thought of evolution at the same time as you did.
To be honest, I don't really want to go into exact details, but I know that our chronology goes back further. I know that we've got more documentation. We've got a major book which we produced. We've got people who've written about it. We've exhibited this work in London, Paris, Perth, Mexico, Cape Town, New York, Beijing, Guangzhou, Nevada, Los Angeles, Prague, Lithuania, Sydney, Toronto, Miami, Korea, Hong Kong, Rome, Milan, Venice, Trieste.
Yeah. We get it.
I'm just saying that in an age of accessible information, it's easily found.
Jennifer, it's also an age when artists claim the right to appropriate, to borrow good ideas and give them their own inflection. What would you say to that defence?
And develop it further.
So your claim is it's just too like what you've done.
Yeah.
Well, Jennifer, thanks for talking to us, and thank you for putting your case so boldly and clearly.
You're welcome.
Jennifer Mara, who is one half of the creative team Maslin and Mara, who believe that their mirrored images have been ripped off by a BBC promotion for a program about First World War. On RN, this is Books and Arts Daily. Well, this case raises some fundamental ethical and legal principles about copyright, which I think will be of interest to artists and to art lovers. Questions about who owns an artistic idea, I guess. Robin Ayres is Executive Director of the Arts Law Centre of Australia, and she's a specialist in issues of copyright and intellectual property law, and she joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Michael. How are you?
Very well. Now, Robin, thank you for looking at the details of this case. I guess the artists are asserting that they own something and that their ownership rights have been breached by the BBC. The BBC is saying that another artist came up with the same idea, so, you know, we're sorry, but that's how it is. Let's just start with some fundamentals. In law, what would you say that the artists, that's Maslin and Mara, actually own?
What we're looking at is basically the principles of copyright. And so when an artist creates a work, they get copyright in that work, which gives them the sole rights to reproduce that work. And if anybody else wants to reproduce the work, they need to come and get permission from the artist. And obviously sometimes artists get a fee for allowing their work to be reproduced. So we're looking at whether or not in this particular case there may well have been a copyright infringement, so that the artist's copyright has been used without their permission.
Now, just to be clear, they're not saying that something they created has been ripped off by the BBC and just used again, not the actual artwork. They're saying that it just looks so like one of their artworks that their very idea has been taken.
Yes, so I suppose there are two issues here. The first is whether or not It's just taking the idea. If you're just using an idea that someone else has come up with and you're taking that idea and using it to create a new work, there's no problem with... actually, we don't have copyright in ideas or in the style of art or in a format for a TV program. So these things are just part of the... information, the knowledge base that everybody is allowed to borrow from and to create new works.
Now, can I just clarify that with you, Robin? Because I think that'll surprise some people. Suppose that I took a dead cat and I put it in a tank of formaldehyde in the style of Damien Hirst, who's famous for putting dead sharks and dead cows and all sorts of dead things into tanks. It looks just like a Damien Hirst. I don't claim it to Damien Hirst. I claim it to Michael Cathcart, but it's clearly in exactly the style of Damien Hirst. You're saying Damien Hirst can't sue me for this.
That's right, because there's no copyright in ideas or style. So, I mean, there's another interesting area with Indigenous art. Someone can make a painting in the style of, you know, an Indigenous artist and use dots, and it can look like an Indigenous artwork. It might be ethically wrong to do that, but as long as they're not claiming that it's they're an Indigenous artist and that they're, you know, they're a particular artist, then there's nothing in law wrong with doing something in the style of or of another artist or using an idea that another artist might come up with.
But I can feel the power of these artists' argument, and I guess you can too. They're saying, this just looks so like our work. You know, we've had this concept. It's not just that we've cut out a mirror and made it look like a soldier. It's the way we've reflected the landscape. It's a way in which we've moved a camera to capture that image moving in a certain way. In all but name, it's our work. That's what they're claiming, isn't it?
So what we have to look at then is, has there actually been a substantial reproduction of their work, and so more than just the idea. So the idea is one aspect, and then when we're actually looking at if there has been a copyright infringement, we look at whether the works are substantially the same. So it is possible for two artists on either side of the world or either side of a country to arrive independently at the same idea or come up with the same works that look very similar. To actually prove that there has been copying, then you need to be able to prove that the second artist actually had an opportunity to see the work and has seen it because it's been exhibited so broadly and they've attended events or something that the artist's work was exhibited at. So that's actually a matter of proof, and it can even be subconscious. Courts have found that one artist has reproduced another artist's work because they have taken on that information subconsciously.
Now, there is a case that might bear on this, I gather, called the Red Bus case, which is quite fascinating. This is a decision, an English decision from 2012. Tell us about the Red Bus case.
This is an important case in terms of this particular issue that's arisen, because the Red Bus case involved a black and white photograph taken at a particular angle of the classic double-decker Red Bus against the backdrop of the Parliament Houses of England. So on the Westminster Bridge with the Parliament Houses in the background. That was the property, the photograph of a souvenir company. Now, along came a company that was making teas, and they thought that would be a great image to put on their teas. And so they basically created a different photograph along the very similar lines, the bus parked on Westminster Bridge with the Houses of Parliament in the background.
We should say that the distinctive thing about the picture is that everything is in black and white except for the bus. So that's a real signature of this idea. There's this bright, well, not even bright red bus, but this red bus against this more sepia kind of background. The colouring in the second picture, the one that was used in the ad for the tea, is exactly the same as the colouring in the original photo, but the angle is different and some of the elements are placed in different positions.
The angle is different. Some of the elements are different. The bus has got closer to the foreground in one of the images, but very much the colours are the same. So that case really had at the heart of it this issue of, well, the second company has just taken the idea of the red bus placed in the black and white landscape. Yes, the same background, but it's done slightly differently, and both of the images were photoshopped.
So the judge found for the artist in that case. He said yes, that the tea company that had created an image very like their image to advertise tea, that they had violated some kind of right, I guess a copyright, that the original photographer had.
That's exactly what they found. They found that the souvenir company that owned the image of the first image of the red bus, that the tea company had actually taken the substantial elements of the photograph and reproduced it in their own. And they broke down the photographs and looked at the different aspects of the photograph. And that, so that case is actually a little controversial, because the argument had been, well, there's no copyright and idea. And the judge looked at the two images side by side and said, actually, there has been a substantial reproduction of the original image. And you can see the argument in this case. If you look at the images side by side, then it does look like there has been a substantial reproduction of the elements of the two sculptors that were first working with this idea of the cutouts of the soldiers in the landscape.
So to summarise, is the situation for the artists this, that prior to 2012 they wouldn't have had an action, because what they're really claiming is an interest in an idea, and you can't have a copyright in an idea. But the Red Bus case, the 2012 case, has thrown that principle slightly into doubt by putting up two photos that are not exactly the same, but very, very similar in their key elements, and saying, well, one actually violates the rights of the other.
Look, I wouldn't take it that far. I think there are other cases where the court has looked at even small elements of an original work have been taken and reproduced, and found that even though it was only a small part of the original work, that there has been a substantial reproduction. So what they look at, whether something is a vital or important part of the original image, I think what the Red Bus case does is add weight to the argument of the two artists who are claiming that their work's been ripped off.
Is it an open and shut case, or do you think there are strong arguments on either side?
There are arguments on either side, so I don't think it's an open and shut case, but I do think that the two artists have probably got a stronger case because of the Red Bus case than they may have had before.
Well, it's an absolutely fascinating issue philosophically, and I'd love to know what you, the listener, think. Just jump online and tell us what you think about this, because on the one hand you've got artists' freedom, the freedom to borrow and adapt and comment on other works, to reference other works, as we like to say, setting that against the artist's right in copyright, the artist's right to protect the integrity of their own work. Robin Ayres, thank you for helping us think those issues through.
My pleasure.
Robin Ayres is Executive Director of the Arts Law Centre of Australia. Across Australia, this is RN. You're listening to Books and Arts Daily. The death of three children at the hands of their father, that's the terrible subject which Helen Garner has written about in her new book, This House of Grief. The book is the story of the trial and conviction for murder of Robert Farquharson. He's a Victorian father who in 2005 drove his car into a dam, killing his three young boys who were travelling with him. Here is Helen Garner opening the Melbourne Writers' Festival last Thursday night with a reading from her book.
I'm going to read from the very beginning of this new book, This House of Grief, and I'm going to start with the dedication. After that, there's a couple of epigraphs. This is the dedication. To the Victorian Supreme Court, this treasury of pain, this house of power and grief. Are you going to the Farquharson hearing? I've got two reactions to this. He can't possibly have done it. But there's no other explanation. Lawyer walking past the Supreme Court of Victoria, 16th of November, 2007. There is no explanation of the death of children that is acceptable. Leon Wieseltier, Kaddish. Life is lived on two levels of thought and act. One in our awareness, and the other only inferable from dreams, slips of the tongue and inexplicable behaviour. Janet Malcolm, The Purloined Clinic. Once there was a hard-working bloke who lived in a small Victorian country town with his wife and their three young sons. They battled along on his cleaner's wage, slowly building themselves a bigger house. One day, out of the blue, his wife told him that she was no longer in love with him. She did not want to go on with the marriage. She asked him to move out. The kids would live with her, she said, and he could see them whenever he liked. She urged him to take anything he wanted from the house. The only thing she asked for and got was the newer of their two cars. The sad husband picked up his pillow and went to live with his widowed father several streets away. Before long, his wife was seen keeping company with the concreter they had hired to pour the slab for the new house. The tradesman was a born-again Christian with several kids and his own broken marriage. Soon the separated wife began to accompany him to his church. Next, the husband spotted the concreter driving around town in the car that he had slaved to buy. Up to this point, you could tell the story as a country and western song, a rueful tale of love betrayed, a little bit whiny, a little bit sweet. But 10 months later, just after dark on a September evening in 2005, while the discarded husband was driving his sons back to their mother from a Father's Day outing, his old white Commodore swerved off the highway, barely 5 minutes from home, and plunged into a dam. He freed himself from the car and swam to the bank. The car sank to the bottom, and all the children drowned. I saw it on the TV news. Night, low foliage, water, misty and black, blurred lights, a chopper, men in high-vis and helmets. Something very bad here, something frightful. Oh, Lord, let this be an accident. Anyone can see the place where the children died. You drive southwest out of Melbourne on the Prince's Highway, the road that encircles the continent. You bypass Geelong, resist the call of the Surf Coast turnoff, and keep going inland in the direction of Colac, on the great volcanic plain that stretches across southwestern Victoria. In August 2006, after a magistrate at a Geelong hearing had committed Robert Farquharson to stand trial on 3 charges of murder, I headed out that way one Sunday morning with an old friend to keep me company. Her husband had recently left her. Her hair was dyed a defiant red, but she had that racked look, hollow with sadness. We were women in our 60s. Each of us had found it in herself to endure, but also to inflict, the pain and humiliation of divorce. It was a spring day. We passed Geelong and were soon flying along between paddocks yellow with capeweed, their fence lines marked by the occasional windbreak of dark cypresses. Across the huge sky sailed flat-bottomed clouds of brilliant white. My companion and I had spent years of our childhoods in this region. We were familiar with its melancholy beauty, the grand, smooth sweeps of its terrain. Rolling west along the 2-lane highway, we opened the windows and let the air stream through. 4 or 5 kilometres short of Winchelsea, we spotted ahead of us the long, leisurely rise of a railway overpass. Was this the place? Talk ceased. We cruised up the man-made hill. From the top, we looked down and saw, ahead and to the right of the road, a body of tan water in a paddock. Not the business-like square of a farm dam, but oval-shaped, feminine, like an elongated teardrop, thinly fringed with small trees. Its southern bank lay parallel with the northern edge of the highway, 20 or 30 metres from the bitumen. I had imagined the trajectory of Farquharson's car as a simple drift off the left side of the highway. But to plunge into this body of water on the wrong side of the road, the car would have had to veer over the centre white line and cut across the eastbound lane with its oncoming traffic. As we sped down the Winchelsea side of the overpass, forcing ourselves to keep glancing to the right, we saw little white crosses, 3 of them, knee-deep in grass between the road and the fence. We flew past as if we did not have the right to stop. We had a vague idea that 6,000 people lived in Winchelsea, but a sign at the entrance to the township gave its population as 1,180. And by the time we had rolled down the dip to the bluestone bridge that spanned the Winchelsea River, then up the other side and past a row of shops and a primary school, the outer limits of the town were already in view. In a place this size, everyone would know your business. A mile or two beyond the township, we turned down a side road and found a grassy spot where we could eat our sandwiches. We felt awkward, almost guilty. Why had we come? We spoke in low voices, avoiding each other's eyes, staring out over the sunny paddocks. Do you think the story he told the police could be true? That he had a coughing fit and blacked out at the wheel? There is such a thing, it's called cough syncope. The ex-wife swore at the committal hearing that he loved his boys, so? Since when has loving someone meant you'd never want to kill them? She said it was a tragic accident, that he wouldn't have hurt a hair on their heads. His whole family's backing him. In court he had a sister on either side and an ironed hanky in his hand. Even the ex-wife's family said they didn't blame him. But wasn't there weird police evidence? The tracks his car had left, and didn't he bolt? Yes, he left the kids in the sinking car and hitched a ride to his ex-wife's place. He looked massive in the photos. Is he a big bloke? No, he was small and stumpy, with puffy eyes. Did you see him close up at the committal? Yes, he held the door open for me. Did he smile at you? He tried to. Maybe he's a psychopath. Isn't that how they get to you, by being charming? He didn't look charming. He looked terrible, wretched. What, you felt sorry for him? Well, I don't know about sorry. I don't know what I was expecting, but he was ordinary, a man. The cemetery on the outskirts of Winchelsea was a couple of acres of wide sloping ground, open to the sky. Nobody else was around. We wandered up and down the rows. No Farquharsons. Perhaps the family came from another town. But as we plodded up the path to the car, I glanced past a clump of shrubbery and saw a tall headstone of polished granite that bore a long surname and three medallion-shaped photos. We approached with reluctant steps. Some AFL fan had poked into the dirt beside the grave an Essendon pinwheel on a wand. Its curly plastic blades whizzed merrily. In the upper corners of the headstone were etched the Essendon Football Club insignia and a golden Bob the Builder. The little boys faced the world with frank good cheer, their fair hair neatly clipped, their eyes bright. Jay, Tyler, Bailey, much loved and cherished children of Robert and Cindy, in God's hands till we meet again. I studied it with a sort of dread. Often in the 7 years to come, I would regret that I had not simply blessed them that day and walked away. In the mown grass sprouted hundreds of tiny pink flowers. We picked handfuls and laid them on the grave, but the breeze kept blowing them away. Every twig, every pebble we tried to weight them with was too light to resist the steady rushing of the spring wind. A year passed between the committal hearing and the trial. When Farquharson's name came up in conversation, people would shudder. Tears would spring to women's eyes. Everyone had a view. The coughing fit story provoked incredulity and scorn. The general feeling was that a man like Farquharson could not tolerate the loss of control he experienced when his wife ended the marriage. Again and again people came up with this explanation. Yes, that must have been it. He couldn't stand to lose control of his family. Either that or he was evil, pure evil. I don't get these guys, said a feminist lawyer. Okay, so the wife dumps them. Men don't have biological clocks. Why can't they just find a new girlfriend and have more kids? Why do they have to kill everyone? Whether he did it on purpose or not, said an older woman, a Christian, how is he going to atone? Countless men declared in anger and distress that it couldn't possibly have been an accident, that a loving father would never leave the car and swim away. He would fight to save his kids, and if he failed, he would go to the bottom with them. Rare were the ones who, after making such a declaration, paused and added in a lower voice, at least, that's what I hope I'd do. When I said I wanted to write about the trial, people looked at me in silence with an expression I could not read. On the 20th of August 2007, 2 years after his car went into the dam, Robert Farquharson's trial opened in the Supreme Court of Victoria. As a freelance journalist and curious citizen, I had spent many days, solitary and absorbed, in the courtrooms of that 19th century pile in central Melbourne, with its dome and its paved inner yards and its handsome facade along William and Lonsdale streets. I knew my way around it and how to conduct myself inside its formal spaces, but I could never approach its street entrance without a surge of adrenaline and a secret feeling of awe. This time I'd brought with me a close friend's daughter, a pale, quiet 16-year-old with white blonde hair and braces on her teeth, dressed in jeans and a sky blue hoodie. Her name was Louise. She was in her gap year. I would come to be grateful for her company and for her precocious intelligence. We squeezed into the press seats of Court 3 with a gang of cheerful journalists. From the tone of their gossip, Farquharson was already hung, drawn and quartered.
Helen Garner opening the Melbourne Writers' Festival with a reading from her new book. It's called The House of Grief and it's published by Text. And Helen will be Natasha's guest tomorrow on Life Matters. So do make sure that you tune in for that right here on RN. This is Books and Arts Daily on RN with Michael Cathcart. Next up to a more joyful topic, the new Doctor Who and a darkly comic film from Sweden.
Do you have a story about an encounter with a stranger?
My heart was pounding in my chest. I'd broken that rule. You don't talk to strangers. Certainly not attractive men on bicycles.
Be a part of RN's Pocket Docs competition by writing or recording a true story about meeting a stranger.
A world of possibilities opens up.
The best story wins an iPad mini. Oh, and you have to mention something you can fit into a pocket. Pocket Docs, I met a stranger. Head to the RN homepage for all the details.
Comrade Stalin wants you to tell him everything you know about the nuclear bomb.
Maybe a drink first.
Suddenly I have blasted my way into a retirement home. And well, one thing certainly leads to another.
If you want to kill me, you better hurry because I'm 100 years old.
Yes, some sounds from the film The 100-Year-Old Man Who Climbed Out the Window and Disappeared. Wonderful title. It's an offbeat, funny and rather dark movie based on a best-selling novel by the Swedish writer Jonas Jonasson. It looks like Jonas Jonasson, but I gather it's pronounced Jonas Jonasson. It's all about a 100-year-old man named Alan who escapes from his retirement home. He jumps out the window moments before his staff, or the staff of the institution, wheel in a cake to celebrate his 100th birthday. And before you know it, he's inadvertently come into possession of a suitcase crammed with cash, which he's taken from a very scary bikie gang, sort of without meaning to, really. And, of course, they're determined to track him down and get it back. Alan's a pretty simple fellow, but in his long and eventful life, he's survived encounters with hostile armies. He's come face-to-face with both Stalin and Franco, and with Harry Truman and Ronald Reagan, when it comes down to it. And he knows a thing or three, as we heard there, about blowing stuff up. This book's a bestseller, rivaling that other Swedish blockbuster, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. So, has this comedy successfully morphed from page to screen? Joining me in the studio are broadcaster and film critic Thomas Caldwell. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
And writer and reviewer Alicia Sometimes.
Good morning.
Just back from a holiday.
Yes, fresh and excited about literature.
With her eyes sparkling. And so that you've both read the book and seen the movie. And also, Thomas and Alicia have watched the new Doctor Who movie, the new Doctor Who episode last year. We'll have a chat about that. And I'd love to hear what you thought. You can ring right now. So it was on last night, on the telly last night. You can text or you can tweet us. So the talkback number is 1300 22 55 76. 1300 22 55 76. That's 1300 call RN. Anywhere in Eastern Australia, from the top of Cape York right down to Tassie, you can call us and tell us what you make of Peter Capaldi as the 12th Doctor, or you can text us on 0418 22 65 76. 0418 22 65 76. We'll talk about Doctor Who in just a tick. But first of all, let's talk about the 100-year-old man who jumped out the window and disappeared. So he's disappeared, Alicia. Why has he disappeared?
Well, the book starts where you can tell that he's fed up. He's in a nursing home. He's got 100 candles on his marzipan cake. He's wearing pea slippers, named so because an old man really pees past his slippers. And you can just get a sense that, you know, he's lived 100 years. Does he have to put up with this indignity? So he jumps out the window and, slowly climbs out the window.
Yes, he doesn't jump. He lowers himself into the flower
gingerly.
Bed.
And he goes to a bus station where, like you said, he inadvertently picks up a lot of cash from a bikie gang and goes to a small remote area where he makes a great friend, Jonas, and Julius. And he then we get the flashbacks of what he was doing 100 years ago, so from birth. And before I even read one review, I knew this would be called the Forrest Gump of literature because he's always in a critical spot in history that changed history in some way, especially he's hanging out with Oppenheimer. He suggests how the atomic bomb should go off.
Oppenheimer's the scientist who developed the atomic bomb at the, what's called the Manhattan
Project. Manhattan Project, that's
right. So at one stage he's got a job, Thomas, he's a sort of waiter or something, is he? He's working in basically catering.
That's right. He's
serving coffee.
Serving coffee.
And he overhears a conversation at the Manhattan Project where they can't work out actually how to get the bomb to explode.
Yes. Yep.
But he knows it's like, because he's an expert on dynamite.
That's the one thing Alan knows about. We establish in the book that he only had 3 years of school. He knows a lot about drinking vodka and he knows a lot about explosives. That's been his passion. So he overhears his conversation and just casually says to Oppenheimer, well, why don't you just do X, Y, and Z? And inadvertently invents the atomic bomb and changes the course of history forever. And Alan sort of does this throughout his whole life. So it is the Forrest Gump comparison, I think, is apt because it's this idea of this person who kind of just blunders their way through history, where Forrest Gump was all about American politics. This is more about European politics. And I suppose on the grander scale, it's about all the conflict in the last century between communism and countries terrified of communism.
Yes, I think that's apt. And he, there's a lot of philosophies within this book, a lot of aphorisms. His dad always said to him, you should be aware of priests, my son, and people who don't drink vodka, worse of all, priests who don't drink vodka. And the whole book is in some ways twee because it's just full of little philosophies that sort of seem somehow put in there. I think so.
Yeah. And the writing style, I think, is also very twee.
Yeah, there's a lot of funny things.
But isn't that what makes it appealing, too? That's what's making it into a super-duper bestseller.
That's right. It's not Scandi noir. It's really that kind of, like the girl with the dragon tattoo. It's kind of, people have said that it may not translate, but it's Swedish humour. And there's a lot of great spots in it where I was having a little giggle. I think it is a satire in a way, but in the book he seems far more likeable. In the film, I think he's a sociopath.
Yeah, in the film he does little more but be drunk, whinge about how difficult it is to urinate, and accidentally kill people. That's sort of the focus of the film. I think this is a really good example of where the condensing process has actually ripped out a lot of the guts of the book in. Not just the fact that we've missed major plot points, but a lot of the more interesting themes and ideas of the book, I think, have been ejected to compress it into a film, and we've lost some of what makes this into a dark satire. And I think instead the film is more of a farcical slapstick with a fairly basic idea about what comes around goes around in a very violently comedic way. I think that's pretty much all the film really delivers.
Unlike the two of you, I've seen the film. Mm. I mean, you've seen the film too, but I've not read the book. Mm-hmm. Mm. I quite enjoyed the film. I mean, I agree with you that it's dark and it's bleak and he does sort of blow people up in a kind of offhand way. But that just seemed to me to be a comment on, you know, one way of looking at the 20th century, that this was the kind of ethos that got him through, because he's not that bright, he's not that reflective, but he looks out for himself, and here he is 100 years old and still chugging along.
Oh, I kind of love the way in the film too that he doesn't take sides. He just adapts, and I think that's what's kept him so alive. He's got 9 lives, you know, with Franco and Stalin and Mao Zedong. He's just, he's got 9 lives. But in the film, he doesn't show any regret about killing people.
No, he doesn't, and
just moves on. And it is like Ferris Bueller in the sense that there is no consequences.
Mm.
He gets away almost with everything.
Well, this is actually an issue I had with the book and the film, is this idea of a character who is, his defining feature is that he's neutral and he doesn't subscribe to any political ideology. And I actually have a big problem with romanticising this point of view, because I think saying you're completely apolitical and you don't believe in anything in itself is quite a political act of saying, I don't care and I'm happy for whatever happens to me externally to happen, and I think that's very destructive, and that apathy causes a lot of damage. So, and I'm wrestling with what the book's trying to say, whether it's trying to celebrate this attitude as a symbol of Swedish neutrality through the ages, or whether it's maybe
just being humorous.
Yeah, or whether it's actually slyly putting in a critique, saying to be neutral and to wander around saying you don't care does end up causing a lot of death and destruction, which is what happens.
You don't want to be his friend. you know, because you probably will die.
You will not live very long at all if you're this man's friend, yeah.
And in the book, there's the nose hair-picking policeman on the case. In the film, he's just seen as sort of a distant character who kind of thinks that Alan Carlson's guilty, but in the book, he's convinced that he's guilty.
Right.
And, it's interesting. Also in the book is Herbert L.
We haven't explained guilty of what. So they're investigating a murder because the bikie ends up dead.
That's right. And in the book, there's three possible murders. In the film, I think there's only two. And I kind of like in the movie how the deaths are cut and we see it's slapstick, a lot of slapstick going on, things being blown up.
I think the movie worked really well at first because I was actually impressed with the way it rapidly moved through multiple storylines. You've got the contemporary story with Alan as a 100-year-old. You've got his backstory with all the historical adventures. Then you've got the story of the cops, the story of the bikie gang. And the film begins really nicely, rapidly moving between all these stories. But then it starts cutting out major plot points, which I think detracts. For example, in the book, he has adventures in Iran and China and South Korea, all conflicts where this communism versus anti-communism sentiment was really muddied and complicated. In the film, that's all ripped out, and it basically
becomes a spy thing, doesn't it?
Well, it reduces the whole dynamic to the US versus the USSR in the most in complete binary oppositions, and I think it's a really reductive way at looking at global politics, just to say it was this side versus this side, and there was no grey.
Well, you know, as listeners to this program know, I'm all for getting away from binary oppositions. Mm. There are always at least three sides to a conflict, otherwise you're not telling anything like the truth. All right, so it looks like the bottom line is read the book.
Yes.
We like the book.
Yeah.
Yeah, the book's pretty fun.
And the film, maybe. If you enjoyed the book, maybe pop along to the
film. You want a bit of whimsy. And the author said it's a hopeful satire on the shortcomings of mankind, and I think he did that well.
All right. So it's called The 100-Year-Old Man Who Climbed Out the Window and Disappeared. It's by Felix Herngren, and it's on national release now. And, the movie's directed by, yes, that's what I said. And the novel is by Eunice Unison, but spelt Jonas Jonason, and it's published by Allen & Unwin. Now let's talk about this. Yes, the very amped up closing titles to Doctor Who, the 2014 theme of Doctor Who, given, as they always do, a revamp. So I'd love to know what you thought about it. It was on last night. It's been seen across the world last night. We're taking talk back from Eastern Australia on 1300 22 55 76. That's 1300 call RN. And you can text us on 0418 22 65 76. 0418 22 65 76. And you can tweet us. We're at RN Books and Arts. Thomas Caldwell and Alicia sometimes are still with me in the studio. So you went off to the cinema. Tell us how this worked. There were actually cinemas screenings
worldwide, in fact, screening this episode that was on last night. It was directed by a film director, and it was, about 90 minutes? So it was a feature-length episode. So they did this last year as well with the 50th anniversary episode.
And you have to say the BBC are brilliant at marketing, are they not?
Oh, yes.
I mean, the whole sense of build-up and anticipation and the announcement of who he was last year and just fantastic. This is so good.
Considering how the classic series basically died a tragic, slow death in the 90s, and I was heartbroken as a teenager when I was at the height of my love of Doctor Who, they have really relaunched this new series impressively and made it into a huge sensation. I can't believe it is cool to like Doctor Who now.
Oh, I know. If
is it cool?
Oh, yeah, it really is. I want to go back to teenage me and say, hang in there. You will be respected one day for fanaticism.
Robin Young is a cool listener. She's tweeted in to say that she loves the new Doctor. Another listener has texted in to say that he or she still misses David Tennant, the 10th incarnation of the Doctor.
I'm with you. As a Whovian, I totally
Tennant
get it.
Tennant was fantastic.
Yeah. It was brilliant.
I thought, David, make it your life's work. I know you can do Hamlet with the Royal Shakespeare Company. Who
Broadchurch. That?
That's it. Yeah. But, you know, maybe you could do that while they're not filming.
But anyway. Having said that, I thought Peter Capaldi was superb.
What an effort.
Well, I mean, another top-class actor taking the role.
His work in the thick of it is sublime. And if you've never watched the TV series, A Thing of It, you will enjoy yourself very much. And I think Peter Capaldi brought some of that William Hartnell dynamic, some of that first Doctor edginess and grumpiness, which gave, I think this series is going to have a new exciting edge.
So William Hartnell is the first Doctor with the long grey hair. I'm old enough to remember that. I've lived through all the Doctors. Anyway, this is what the ninth, no, what is he, the 12th Doctor?
12th.
The 12th Doctor sounds like.
I'm the Doctor. I've lived for over 2,000 years, and not all of them were good. I've made many mistakes, and it's about time that I did something about that. Clara, I'm not your boyfriend.
I never thought you were.
I never said it was your mistake.
Yes, the good old TARDIS hasn't changed that sound in all those years. I wonder how they make that noise. Someone will know. Someone will text in and tell us.
I could explain over the next 10 minutes, but yeah.
Yeah, and this, it is the Scottish Doctor. I love that because he's got the Scottish accent.
But how funny that David Tennant was a Scot and had to put on it. Well, that's what he had to, but he put on a sort of educated English accent. Now this time they've allowed the Scottish actor to be Scottish.
I really thought Clara Oswald, his companion, because the Doctor, of course, if you've never watched it, has many companions travelling with him. Some friendly, some flirty. I thought she was the voice of the audience to say, no, hang in there. You're not exactly the same, but I'm going to love you anyway.
Well,
I thought she did brilliantly.
But what a strange way to start a show. I can't imagine American producers allowing this because what happens is the Doctor steps out of the TARDIS and he's old and wrinkled and grey and she's disappointed.
I was disappointed.
Oh, no, look at you. Yep. Oh, you can't be the Doctor.
Well, Matt Smith and David Tennant, sexy. Matt Smith in his own little way. Christopher Eccleston I wasn't so crazy about, but now I can't crush on Peter Capaldi. I just can't.
Oh,
I can like him. You can
kiss
him.
I wouldn't crush on him, sure. I mean, he's not pretty.
No, but I can imagine.
But he's got attack eyebrows, and that's magnificent.
But they have made him look even paler than he actually
that's
is.
Right.
I mean, he's got very white hair and very white skin. Almost a little bit. Well, he's, of course, not human. And I have read that one of the approaches they're going to take with this Doctor is actually to work on the idea that, yes, the Doctor is not human.
Yeah, I think he is the closest to the classic Doctors,
we've had
in this new series to date. I love the other three guys in the classic series, but I think Capaldi is a real overt effort to go back to that original series that began in 1963, and I'm right on board with that dynamic. I also, just going back to Clara, I think this is the first time we've seen that character get something to do and to become
a
character with agency as well. I'm really glad they took the direction they did with her in the episode last night because
instead of just clever lines and...
She was really being wasted during the Matt Smith era. As much as I enjoyed the Matt Smith era, I thought that she was a neglected character and we got a lot more from her last night.
Sue and Hobart has texted, beautifully scripted program last night. Love the way they managed to change the face. Challenge us to love and accept the new Doctor. Yeah, well, that's what we're saying. Yes.
It was dinosaurs.
Oh, what's this? Listener said this. Doctor Who? I'd prefer Dr. Phil. Brain numbing versus brain analysing.
Oh,
probably a Star Trek fan.
Different planets.
Yeah.
Absolutely different universes.
I feel a bit sorry for people who've never got on the Doctor Who train because you're just missing out.
Yeah, we're sorry for you, Anonymous.
We are.
You go to your doctor.
Come on, Gallifrey. It's a good planet.
Yeah. So, come on, someone give us a call. The talkback number is 1300 22 55 76. You can talk to Australia, but you've only got 2 minutes to make that call. 1300 22 55 76. 1300 call RN. Or you can text us on 0418 22 65 76. So this business of the companion and the sexual frisson that usually exists between the Doctor is a bit of a problem here because Clara is very, very young. I mean, she looks almost girlish Capaldi. So he's had to be sort of chaste. You know, I'm not the hugging kind.
I'm not your boyfriend.
I'm not your boyfriend and I don't like to hug.
Well, I think that's very much a response to some of the criticism of this new series. I mean, that romantic, the Doctor as a romantic figure first appeared in the Paul McGann telly movie. Paul McGann made a wonderful Doctor, but that telly movie was pretty awful.
It's awful.
And that romantic element remained in the new series, and I've always had a problem with it because the Doctor is like 2,000 years old. And to have him flirting with women in their 20s.
But Donna Noble, and there was one.
Donna was an exception.
Yeah.
But the David Tennant character dealt with that. He was old and ultimately lonely.
Mm.
You remember that? That was his torment, that he was alone in the universe and these people were just kind of passing.
Except for River Song, his true love.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, it got complicated. It's
complicated.
If the Doctor was on Facebook, it would be It's Complicated with every single companion.
That's right.
Maggie's called us. Maggie has been a Doctor Who fan forever. Welcome, Maggie. What did you make of it last night? Have we got Maggie?
Hello?
Yes, Maggie, you're on air. What did you make of the show last night?
I'm a 77-year-old Doctor Who fan.
Wow.
Marvellous. And
I've been watching it forever.
And are you drawn to this elderly doctor, or would you like a more sprightly doctor?
No, he's fine. I mean, it's like everything. It's just a matter of getting used to it, isn't it?
Yes. What did you make of the fact that the dinosaur had been transported to 19th century London? I thought that if you had the TARDIS inside a dinosaur, the TARDIS would travel, but it wouldn't drag the dinosaur with it. I was worried about the logic of that, Maggie.
Well, I found that a little bit like you, but that's Doctor Who.
Yes, you just have to go with it, don't you?
Yes. With any of it.
Good idea.
There was some spontaneous combustion. I didn't kind of get that.
Oh, I quite like the spontaneous combustion. Oh, now, see, everyone's ringing in now with only 5 minutes to go. Michael, thank you, Maggie. Michael, you've seen all the doctors, Michael.
Hello?
Yes, Michael, you're on air.
Sorry. Mikhail's my name.
Mikhail, good to have you with us.
Yes, seen all the doctors. There's been a few gaps over the years where I haven't watched it all. Yes, I agree with you. The original Doctor, it's going back there. I loved Last Night. I think he's brilliant. I think he's going to... Look, I love Doctor Who, don't get me wrong, but it's all a bit whiz-bang sometimes for the oldies, you know? Like the original where it was really bad, really appalling in the BBC.
Bad sets.
Backlog, you know, with really bad costumes and...
Good on you, Mikhail.
It's part of the charm of the original series, I agree.
Yeah, it's got a lot of... a lot of the concepts, look, it's doing my head in sometimes when they, you know, reverse the polarity too much and go backwards inside the wormhole of their own mind, and then it's only a mirror and then whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Hang in there, Mikhail, it'll all work out. Barry's called... We'll move on, Mikhail, because there's a few calling in. Barry's called from Mount Isa. You liked it?
Yes, I didn't think it was too bad, actually. I quite liked it, and... I think the rest of the series will be quite good. I mean, the thing is with Doctor Who, I mean, you can't expect it to stay the same indefinitely. There's got to be flux and change as the years go on. But so long as the underlying tenets of the program remain the same, that's the most important thing, I think.
Tenets is a good word to
use. That's right. Yeah. And it's a brilliant concept, to change. I mean,
the core concept is so flexible, and yet, yeah, I think those core ideas are essential.
I thought we knew we were in Doctor Who territory once they went into that restaurant and you saw it was occupied by menacing automatons.
That's right.
I thought, okay, we've had the setup, we've met Peter Capaldi, now we're back in Doctor Who.
Anything
the challenge is these mechanical people who... And not really eating. You know, it was classic, wasn't it?
And as an adult, I keep thinking, I'm not going to be frightened, you know, and then statues come along or automatons.
Yeah,
and
automatons harvesting organs. It's a terrifying idea.
Frightened.
Yeah.
Michael's in Brisbane and has got something to tell us about thoughts on the writers, Michael.
Just quickly, I'm sorry to disagree with everyone, but I really think the writers and the writing of the new Doctor Who is appalling. Some of the worst writing I've seen on TV. As a fan of Doctor Who all my life, 45 years, I don't expect to be scared and thrilled like a child when I was watching Doctor Who, but I do expect a lot better than what I'm getting. Honestly, it is like a metaphor for how things were so much better 20 years ago when people tried a lot less to impress people that, yeah, basically the public, instead of just, I mean, and also the rehashing of the scripts and characters is too much. They're just... They are making themselves a cliche. It's ridiculous.
Good on you, Michael. Thank you for calling. And we'll have to leave it there. Thank you to all of you who called and texted. So it looks as though, apart from Michael's reservation about the writing, we basically like the show.
That's right. A couple of bad jokes, but apart from that, brilliant.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, Alicia and Thomas, thank you for coming in.
Pleasure.
Thank you,
Thomas.
That was fun.
Caldwell and Alicia, sometimes. And I gave you the details of the book. I did. And that concludes the program for today. Don't forget, we're reading Memoirs of a Dutiful Daughter by Simone de Beauvoir. That's our book for August, our European classics. And tomorrow, you're going to meet Emma McBride talking to me at this year's Sydney Writers' Festival. Her book is called A Half-Formed Thing. It's a wonderfully strange and evocative novel. I reckon it's going to be my book of the year. Well, there's still a bit of the year to go, but it's certainly in my top three or four books. Cameron Wilson, what's coming up?
Reaction to mandatory reporting of animal abuse. That's what the RSPCA wants. And also the environmental benchmarks in the Murray-Darling Basin. That's coming up.
That's Bush Telly coming up straight after the news. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is RN. Bye-bye.